It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about new research into the effect bullying has on the brain of the person doing the bullying. First, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson has introduced a new amendment that would block the Department of Justice from enforcing part of the Americans with Disabilities Act at private schools that accept vouchers. The provision was added to a pending bill and comes after a federal probe investigated schools in Milwaukee after it was alleged that these schools were discriminating against students with disabilities. The key concern was whether private schools, while accepting taxpayer money in the form of vouchers, were subject to the same federal laws that public schools are held to. Joining us now is Molly Beck. She's a reporter who covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you walk us through how Senator Johnson's amendment would change the way the Department of Justice could enforce the Americans with Disabilities Act in voucher schools?
Well, the amendment, it seeks to block the use of federal dollars to enforce a provision of the American Disabilities Act that is for public schools and government institutions. And what that provision does is it ensures that, you know, students with disabilities have equal access to those institutions. And this amendment would keep federal dollars from being used to enforce that provision in voucher schools. And the reason is that there's public money going to these voucher schools despite the schools being private.
So when we talk about equal access, can you talk about what kinds of things we might be looking at when we're talking about equal access in schools and voucher schools?
Sure. The voucher schools, they're not public schools, they're not subject to the same laws that govern public schools that require, schools to be accessible and to be able to accommodate students with disabilities, their education plans, for example, that requires, a special teacher and a special education plan and things like that. So that's kind of the crux of this, that there's... It comes after a investigation into the Milwaukee public school voucher system in the Milwaukee Public School District, and the federal government found that there was no wrongdoing, but there were allegations that because the voucher schools were not didn't have the same accommodations as public schools, that they were discriminating against students with disabilities because they could not attend those schools.
And might we also be talking about things like infrastructure and special things to accommodate the blind as well?
Yep. Accessibility in all of those areas, yes.
What is Senator Johnson's argument for this amendment?
When I spoke to his office, they said that the amendment is meant to protect the voucher schools from the federal government applying a part of the American Disabilities Act that they say is not meant for private voucher schools. And there are some court rulings in the past that have said, just because a private school receives public money in the form of a school voucher doesn't transform them into a public school subject to all the laws that public schools are. And from, Senator Johnson's perspective, in speaking to his office, they believe that there's a hostile attitude from the current Obama administration toward voucher programs, and saw the probe into the Milwaukee voucher system as being a result of that. And not based on allegations that they felt were accurate, obviously.
And not everyone clearly would be supportive of this measure. What have critics of the amendment had to say against the provision?
Sure. I spoke to some advocates of students with disabilities, and they're concerned that, in voucher schools, if there's one more, roadblock to ensuring that some of the provisions in the ADA are, enforced in these schools, then the students there will not be receiving, the proper services that they need, or they won't be able to go to school altogether. The state just created a new voucher program just for students with disabilities, and so I was asking about that. What would this do for that program? And the Department of Public Instruction said that the amendment would block oversight of that law, the ADA law, in schools that are in the voucher program.
Is there a sense here in Wisconsin how proponents of voucher schools would respond to the amendment?
Sure. School Choice Wisconsin is probably the most prominent advocate for voucher schools in the state. And, you know, I spoke to the president of School Choice Wisconsin, and he said that, you know, this amendment, all it does is just, you know, kind of restates, you know, what court rulings have already said, that just because, you know, a private school has students there using public money does not make them, you know, a public school. And, you know, any violations of the ADA will still be investigated. There are still, you know, provisions for that. It doesn't block the DOJ from investigating voucher schools from violating the ADA altogether.
Has Senator Johnson responded to the question from some critics about how voucher schools would ensure that there was equal access without the oversight of the Department of Justice?
Sure. I wasn't able to speak with Senator Johnson directly, but, you know, there's a provision of the ADA that applies to private schools, and this amendment doesn't affect that. And from their perspective, you know, it blocks the federal government from using any money to enforce a provision of the law that they believe is not appropriate for private schools. So violations will still, you know, in private schools will still be handled.
We're talking with Molly Beck right now. She's a reporter who covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. And she's with us now to talk about a proposed amendment that would block the Department of Justice from enforcing parts of the Americans with Disabilities Act in voucher schools. And this comes from Senator Ron Johnson. And looking at where we stand currently, what kinds of rules do private schools and religious private schools have to follow currently?
Well, when it comes to accessibility, you know, the private schools are not required to have, you know, a full-fledged special education program, and are not required to take, you know, every student that comes to them and create a program for them if they have disabilities. That's what public schools are asked to do. So that's the difference here, and kind of, you know, the reason that there's a debate around that, because there are these voucher programs, and you know, they take public money in the form of a voucher. So people that are advocates for public schools, they say that, you know, if a school receives any public money like that, then they should be subject to the same rules as the public schools are. But there are these court rulings, and voucher school advocates have said, you know, just because these students are there doesn't mean they're attending a public school. They're still attending a private school.
Now, Senator Johnson has said in part that this proposed amendment came about because of his concerns about unfair scrutiny from the Obama administration. So has the White House administration had anything to say about the amendment so far? Any response?
I reached out to the Department of Education and the Department of Justice, and both declined to comment about it. So I'm not sure, you know, where they fall on this amendment, but I know that, you know, if you just look at the probe that they had in the Milwaukee voucher system, that was, you know, years long, and it you know, was shut down a few months ago, and they saw that there was no wrongdoing there. So, but other than that, you know, I'm not sure what they think of this current amendment.
Now, this fits into a larger debate around school funding and a divide between private schools and public schools. How do you see this particular issue, this amendment, fitting into that big picture?
Sure. I think it's just another part of the discussion that is pretty longstanding between public school advocates, public school, you know, officials, and, you know, lawmakers and voucher school advocates. One side says that, you know, with the expansion of the voucher programs in Wisconsin, you know, with that has been a reduction in funding for public schools, or a reduction of attention for public schools, so to speak. And, you know, on the other side, you have lawmakers and people who support the voucher program saying, you know, there are students who want to attend, you know, a quote unquote better school. And this is the way they can do that because it's, you know, these programs, for the most part are for families that, you know, have income limits. So it's not, a program for just anybody. It's families that might not be able to move somewhere else and attend a voucher school or a private school, or a different public school. This fits into that, you know, debate because I think the disability, the students with disabilities, those advocates are saying that, you know, if you're going to take any public money, then these rules that apply to public schools must apply there too, to ensure that those students are getting the services they need.
And Molly, just briefly before we let you go, what's the next step with the amendment?
You know, it's in this appropriations bill and it hasn't been passed yet. And I'm not sure where that's going to go, but, I'm sure I'll follow up on it.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Molly Beck, a reporter covering politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. And she was with us there to talk about a proposed amendment from Senator Ron Johnson that would block the Department of Justice from enforcing parts of the Americans with Disabilities Act in voucher schools. Coming up, new research shows that in some people, the brain's reward center lights up when that person engages in bullying. We'll learn more about those findings in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after a public outcry for a judge to be removed for giving what some people saw as a lenient sentence to the Stanford rapist, we talked to a Wisconsin judge about when and how a judge can be punished. First, we talk a lot about bullying and the effect it may have on the victims, but we don't usually hear about the effect that bullying has on the bullies themselves. Now, new research just released shows that in some cases, the bully, in this case, it was a mouse bully, is stimulated in the reward center of the brain. And this research could help target alternative forms of treatment for bullying behavior. And joining us now to talk about the research is Scott Russo. He's an associate professor of neuroscience at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. It's nice to be here.
So with all the emphasis on victims and the surrounding community involved, why did you decide to look here at the brain of the bully?
You know, we spend most of our resources trying to come up with treatments to fix or reduce harm that has been placed on an individual. And in terms of treating illness across the spectrum, not just psychiatric illness, a better approach, a better strategy may be to prevent the pathology to begin with. In this case, the pathology is induced by violence towards that individual from another individual.
So walk us through how you set up your research on this.
Well, so I'm glad you highlighted the fact that these are preclinical studies, meaning that they're done in mice and not in humans, but they are informed by findings from human studies. And just to give a brief background on what motivated us to initiate these studies was a series of imaging studies a few years back showing that individuals that suffered from antisocial personality disorder or in its most extreme form, psychopathy, they noted that there was activation of brain reward centers, in particular the nucleus accumbens, which receives dopamine from a structure known as the VTA. And this was in response to visualizing images of other individuals that were in pain or being hurt. And so we wanted to develop a mouse model that could recapitulate aspects of that syndrome. So the way that we did this was we screened a strain of mouse that is particularly aggressive, or at least certain individuals within that strain are particularly aggressive, and we subtyped them and classified them into aggressive versus non-aggressive forms. We then developed a test to ask them, since we can't use subjective report, we developed a test to ask them whether or not they found stimuli or environmental context associated with bullying behavior or aggression, whether they found those rewarding. And to do that, we allowed an animal to attack and bully an intruder mouse in one particular environment, and the environment was very distinguishable from other environments. And then on the following day, that animal would be placed in the alternate environment with different environmental cues, and they were not allowed to bully an intruder mouse. We did this for a series of days, and on the test day, we asked them which environment they preferred. And the bullies preferred the environment in which they were able to bully and subordinate an intruder mouse. This test was adapted from a classic tool that's been used to determine the addictive properties of drugs of abuse. And drugs of abuse across the spectrum, from cocaine to alcohol to heroin, all induce the same form of learning that we call conditioned place preference.
So are you saying bullying is a conditioned behavior that we get rewarded for in a way like addiction?
Exactly, and it might even impact future bullying episodes, much like cocaine experience may or is well known to affect future drug intake, and it may be through the same circuits.
So are we able at this point in the research to look at how you might intercept that reward response to bullying?
You know, at this point, we are using invasive tools in order to disrupt a circuit within the brain. So these tools are not quite yet accessible for use in humans, although they may be one day. So the way that we did this was we first identified this reward circuit, and we confirmed that there was differential activation of this brain area that we know controls reward responses to a number of different stimuli after the animal was allowed to bully another subordinate individual. We then used a tool. It's a newer tool in the neurosciences called optogenetics. And this is it's a genetic tool that allows us to control the activity of specific nerve cells within the brain. And we were able to do two things. One was to recapitulate the overactive circuit in non-aggressive mice, and show that we could change the valence or the reward experience of that individual.
I'm going to jump in. What do you mean by recapitulate?
So we could produce a preference for a social interaction with an intruder in one of our non-aggressive mice. We couldn't make them fight, but we could make them change their preference so that they preferred environmental context, much like the aggressor mouse did. And we could do the opposite, where we inhibited that circuit in aggressors, and we shut down aggressive behavior, and we prevented this reward association that we had shown in those animals. So it's a proof of concept study to suggest that if we were to target these circuits either pharmacologically through drugs or through newer technologies like deep brain stimulation, we may be actually able to recode the brain reward circuits so that these individuals don't find the events rewarding, and hopefully so that they stop bullying in the future.
We're talking with Scott Russo now from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, talking about new research looking into bullying and its effect on the reward centers of the brain. And as we were talking about, this was research done on mice. What makes us think that we'll see a parallel in human beings?
Well, so it's a really good point. The studies that we do preclinically are meant to identify mechanisms that we were unable to identify in humans. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, there is some evidence that humans, and particular humans with antisocial personality disorder, do exhibit this same type of overactive reward circuit in response to stimuli associated with others that are injured or hurt. So there is some translational value. But what's critically important, and in order for us to take this to the next step, is we have to find biology in our mice that is recapitulated in the human syndromes. So we have to be able to go back and forth between these two circuits and show that what we find in a mouse is what we find in a human. So these are very early days, and I don't want to make more out of the story than it is, other than to say we've identified a primary reward circuit in a mouse. These reward circuits in mice are highly conserved across humans. They seem to be activated similarly in humans that like to bully and like to engage in violence towards one another. And the next step would be to show causality in the human. And we're, I think, a number of years away from that.
Were you surprised that these results showing that there is actually biological reinforcement happening when the certain subset of mice is bullying another set of mice?
You know, we weren't. We based our hypotheses on a rich literature, both in animals and in humans. And, you know, it's maybe not quite as extreme as the type of violence that we're talking about in these studies, but there's a well-known effect called the winner effect, and it exists across sports in humans. It exists across all species, including humans and mice, obviously. But this winner effect is basically operates on the assumption that individuals that are able to subordinate or win have release of dopamine into their nucleus accumbens, which is a neurochemical associated with pleasure and reward. So the idea that subordination of another individual was rewarding is not new. Showing causal effects and showing that we can manipulate this through this specific circuit was what was unexpected.
So what might be the next steps in making a transition to humans and eventually way down the road to some kind of treatment?
Excellent question. I think we need to find the right patient population. You know, violence and bullying behavior occurs for many different reasons, and I don't think activation of reward circuits or gaining pleasure out of it is the only factor influencing aggression and violence in humans. So we need to find the right patient population, and we need to start with detailed functional imaging studies. So this is putting an individual into a scanner and looking at the activity of the brain in real time, understanding exactly how our patient population responds to these aggressive and violent stimuli. And then from there, what we need to do is we need to transition towards therapeutics development. Once we've got human models that are viable and valid, we can transition to therapeutics development and figure out what best treats the violence and aggression in those patients.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us. That was Scott Russo, an associate professor of neuroscience at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, talking about new research on bullying. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. For a lot of kids, summer is an exciting time of activities and camp, but some researchers think that a little bit of boredom can be a good thing for children. We'll hear more in a bit. First, news out of California weeks ago left sexual assault victims' rights advocates disappointed. A judge gave a former Stanford University swimmer probation and 6 months in prison after he was convicted of raping an unconscious and intoxicated woman. But the next day, a Change.org petition had collected 191,000 signatures to recall the judge who delivered that sentence, Santa Clara County Superior Court Judge Aaron Persky. In California, like Wisconsin, recalling a judge is a possibility because they're elected. Judge Jean D'Amato joins us now. She was a judge for more than 15 years and last presided in felony court, now serves as a reserve judge. She recently published an article about the question of punishing judges in the Wisconsin Law Journal. Judge D'Amato, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Now, you've looked at the legal history here in this state. What in Wisconsin have we seen similar calls for a judge to be punished or to be removed?
We've seen it twice. The first time was in the mid-70s in Dane County when Judge Archie Simonson sentenced three teenage boys to essentially home detention for raping their classmate. They had done it in a stairwell that was right near the choir room so that no one could hear her screams or protests. There was a huge outcry, and the outcry was not just to the sentence, it was to his remarks, which were that, how could you blame them? They were reacting normally to the sexually permissive atmosphere that he felt was present in Dane County, and what he thought was sexually permissive or promiscuous types of dress by women. The uproar continued because, in part, he kept giving interviews, both in Dane County as well as in the state and nationally, and continued to espouse his beliefs that the boys were reacting normally, that it was women's dress and a sexually permissive society that was responsible for their conduct. So a recall petition was initiated. It was the first recall that ever took place in the state of Wisconsin's history, and he was recalled as a result of the petitions being filed and an election was held. Moria Krieger became his replacement. She was the first woman judge in Dane County and served for 30 years after that. So he's the only example in Wisconsin of a judge who was recalled for behavior that the electorate found reprehensible.
So that was the public taking him to task, not agreeing with the opinions that he was putting out there in interviews. So when you look at that case here in Wisconsin, what parallels do you see when you look at the Stanford case?
Well, in the Stanford case, it also involves a sexual assault. The perpetrator of the sexual assault was older. He was 19, not a high school student. He was a student athlete at Stanford, and despite a jury convicting him of three felonies for the sexual assault, the judge sentenced him to, as you mentioned, probation with 6 months in jail. He thought that a sentence that that the convictions themselves would have a severe impact on him, and that a more severe sentence would be too much. What's difficult about the case in California is that it's some 40 years or so after the case in Wisconsin. So our attitudes about sexual assault have evolved since that time as a society and as a culture. In addition, what's hard for me to have seen in that case was that the judge had a mandatory minimum imposed by the legislature of at least a sentence of 2 years of imprisonment.
Right. Why can a judge only assign 6 months jail when the mandatory is 2 years?
You know, there's a judge in Wisconsin who sentences drunk drivers to less than the mandatory minimum. I don't get that myself. A minimum set by the legislature is a mandatory minimum, and you have to follow that law, in my view. So that's in part what caused such a huge furor in California, was probation in light of these three felony convictions when the mandatory minimum was 2 years at least of imprisonment.
So you mentioned that evolving attitudes are difficult when you look at this case, evolving attitudes towards sexual assaults. What in particular are you thinking about when you say that?
Well, for example, the idea that women's dress somehow invites sexual assault, or that a woman's, looking back, for example, at the Archie Simonson case in 1977, the teenage girl in high school was wearing a turtleneck and slacks. You know, how that could possibly be construed as inviting rape is, you know, hard to believe.
And these days, a lot of advocates, probably most people would say it shouldn't matter what you're wearing.
Precisely. How a man's self-control over his own sexual violence is somehow a woman's issue and needs to be addressed by her choice of clothing is crazy.
So right now we are talking to Judge Jean D'Amato. She was a judge for more than 15 years, last presided in felony court. She's now a reserve judge, talking about when it's appropriate and how it works to punish a judge, looking at the outcry after petitions went out to have California Judge Aaron Persky removed when he granted a 6 month jail sentence to a Stanford athlete convicted of raping an unconscious woman. So looking now at that petition, 191,000 signatures at one count there, to recall, and I guess that's one option. What are other options now that you have this petition in action? How could this play out?
There is another petition drive also, and that's for impeachment of the judge. His situation is somewhat unique in that he's up for re-election but unimposed. In addition, he seemed to have been a judge up through now that was a respected judge, an even-handed judge, a moderate judge. So how the recall will play out, I don't know. Impeachment is a process that we have in Wisconsin as well, although no judge in Wisconsin has been impeached. But it's a legislative process where the assembly or the house of a state legislature would vote if they have corrupt conduct in office or for crimes and misdemeanors. They would vote for impeachment, and then there would be a trial in the Senate. We saw that with other public figures like Clinton, who was impeached but exonerated by the Senate. So we know the process from other political positions, not so much with judges, but there is an impeachment petition drive in California for Judge Persky as well.
Now, you mentioned his past history, and you said he had a reputation for being a moderate judge. And in this case, we're looking at his sentencing in one particular case. So how do you weigh that? What was it, 40 years as a judge with a reputation as a moderate and one case, which is his raised a lot of outcry. How would that play out as public opinion and any of these motions move forward?
It's very difficult. Professor Dan Blinka at Marquette's Law School has commented that impeaching a judge or recalling a judge for one decision is a hard thing to see. Judges are elected to six-year terms, and he thought that's the record they should be judged on. And in fact, he's articulating the majority view that one decision shouldn't be outcome determinative of whether you stay in office or not. The other thing I notice is that it's always a lenient decision that, or typically, I should say, it's a lenient decision in sentencing that raises an outcry. Those who have sentenced defendants to unduly harsh or unconscionably harsh sentences don't seem to be called out in the same way. And I look at that as a factor as well.
When you look at Wisconsin, that case you began with, I think his name was Judge Archie Simonson. It sounds as though that recall was based on a single decision as well. So is there, you know, some other precedent maybe beyond Wisconsin that it can happen on a single decision?
Well, yes. And as I mentioned earlier, the fact that he kept giving interviews espousing his points of view about the society and about Dane County electorate and about women in Dane County didn't help his cause. It made it a matter of people losing confidence that he actually, as a judge, represented their values and mores. And Judge Persky, on the other hand, has said nothing. He has not publicly commented, and I give him credit for that.
We're talking with Judge Gene D'Amato right now, talking about the question of when and how judges should be punished. After petitions went out to have California Judge Aaron Persky removed when he granted a lenient sentence, as some people see it, to a Stanford athlete convicted of raping an unconscious woman. And we want to hear from you on this. How do you think that judge should have ruled in that case? Are you one of the people that believes that he should be recalled? Call 800-642-1234. How do you think judges should be punished based on their decision in one case? Or should we instead look at the choices over a period of time, a period of years maybe? And if you're in the justice system or an advocate of victims' rights, give us a call at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up our conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and right now we're picking up our conversation with Judge Gene D'Amato, talking about The question of when judges, if judges, should be punished after petitions recently asked to remove California Judge Aaron Persky, who gave a 6-month jail sentence to the Stanford student convicted of sexually assaulting an unconscious woman. And we want to know what you think. How do you see Judge Persky's decision? Do you see certain biases in this case? And tell us if you believe that judges should be removed based on a signal decision or punished in some manner. And do you think we have the right mechanisms to do that? Call us at 800-642-1234. And how does the decision impact the conversation about campus rape for you? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. And we'll take our first caller now. We have Micah with us first in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Micah.
Hi. I guess I had recently read, and maybe you can confirm if this is true or not, that he tried a very similar case. I think it was only 2 years ago, where a young black man who was not wealthy or affluent or in school was charged with very similar charges. And he actually pled guilty for a plea deal, acknowledged his guilt, said he was sorry, apologized to the victim, and got close to the maximum sentence. Whereas then just a couple years later, he gave, you know, the rich white kid in school who went to his school as an athlete a break for very similar charges, even though that individual has never admitted his guilt. He and his father are still claiming that he didn't do anything wrong. You know, he's making up all these excuses, saying, well, he's going to start a program to teach kids about the danger of alcohol, as if that made him do anything. And so when they keep saying, well, is it right to pull a judge over one case? It's not one case. It's viewing cases of similar incidents side by side.
Micah, thanks for that. Now, I'm not familiar with the second case that Micah mentioned, Judge D'Amato, but if there were to emerge a pattern that showed that perhaps this was an issue of concern in Judge Persky's rulings, how would that change things?
Micah raises an interesting issue, actually a couple of issues. The first is a racial disparity, it sounds like, if I understood his question correctly. There's two things I want to say. One is that's something a judge should always be checking on. I used to do that from my first month on the bench. Was I sentencing someone differently because of the color of their skin? Was I sentencing them more harshly or more leniently depending on their ethnic background? I did a constant check to make sure that if this person, if it was a black person in front of me, I would say, if this was a white person, would my sentence be different? And I think judges have an ethical obligation to monitor their behavior in that way when they're sentencing. The other point he raises that interests me is the attitude between the two different defendants that he described. The first accepted responsibility by pleading guilty, and Brock Turner in California, the one sentenced by Judge Persky from Stanford, had a jury trial and was convicted by a jury of three felonies. His father's attitude was I found truly shocking. It was, it shouldn't be a harsh sentence. It shouldn't even be jail time or much less prison time, because it was just, quote unquote, 20 minutes of action. That's an appalling attitude. And it would have concerned me as a judge sentencing someone like Brock Turner if a parent espoused that kind of an attitude, because that would lead me to wonder seriously if the character of the defendant was formed by those kinds of attitudes in the household. One of the things that's hard as well about judging judges' sentences, when we're not the ones actually doing the sentencing, is we usually don't hear all that's said in a courtroom. We don't read the things that are submitted to a judge, and yet we're judging that sentence. So that's a difficulty. we heard in the Stanford case from the victim, because that was published on social media, and so that her whole statement, which was a lengthy one and a heartrending one, was available, and that contrasted with Brock Turner's father's statement was difficult at best.
Let's take another caller now. Thanks to Micah for his call. And we go next to Jessica in Oliver. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I was 16 when I was raped, and people who don't have this experience, they cannot reach inside of themselves and know what it's like or to feel what it feels like. Self-confidence and self-respect and all of these good things get taken away from you. And it takes years, if ever, that anyone can actually recover from that kind of thing, because it just deep down inside of yourself is violated. And, you know, people that don't go through this and feel it themselves really have no idea what people go through for the rest of their life.
Jessica, I'm so sorry for what you went through. I'm glad you called us to share your voice here on this. And I'm curious about how you responded to the rape victim statement on social media that affected a lot of people.
You know, those people should never be criminalized. You know, victims are way too often criminalized. And, you know, I went back to my mother at the time and nothing was ever done. So, you know, even today, people keep that secret because they don't want to be singled out and pointed at, you know, that kind of thing.
Jessica, I'm very sorry to hear of your situation, and you bring up such an excellent point, and that's the impact on the victim versus the impact on the defendant in a sentence, saying that the judge in California said that there would be a severe impact on the young man, and what the victim's statement had said in clarion tones is that the impact on the victim is long and lasting and deep and frightening.
We're talking with Judge Jean D'Amato right now about the Stanford rape case and the verdict there from Judge Persky, which a lot of people saw as too lenient. And Jessica brought up, you know, the feelings of the rape survivor, and a lot of people, I think, were exposed to those feelings in a way maybe they hadn't been before, thanks, as you said, to the social media publishing of the complete statement, which a lot of people had very emotional responses to. Is that something new, do you think, in the way that we as a public and maybe eventually in the judicial system perceive the damage of rape?
Well, judges should take that into consideration. When we sentence, for example, in Wisconsin, we take into consideration three primary factors: the gravity or the seriousness of the crime, secondly, the character of the defendant, and thirdly, the interests of the community, both for punishment as well as for rehabilitation. The victim's point of view comes across in two of those factors: in the gravity of the crime and the aggravating circumstances of the crime, and again, as a member of the community who's been impacted by the crime, so that the community's interest in punishment and rehabilitation have to be viewed in part through the eyes of the victim and the victim's point of view.
And looking at some of the options we've talked about so far, as we get ready to wrap up here, not a lot of time left, but we talked about impeachment and recall. What about some sort of reprimand or censure? Is that something that might be on the table?
Yes. Discipline of a judge is available in Wisconsin, as it is in every state. And in our state, it's through the Judicial Commission. They start the procedure. They can issue a private reprimand, or they can issue I know they have two options there, and it's slipping my mind. I apologize. A private reprimand or a warning. The Wisconsin Supreme Court itself can impose discipline on a judge, which is a public reprimand or a period of suspension that can vary from 60 days to 90 days to up to 2 years or for the remainder of the judge's term.
And we leave it there. Judge D'Amato, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Judge Jean D'Amato. She was a judge for more than 15 years, now serves as a reserve judge, joining us there to talk about cases in which a judge could be punished after a lot of people called for the removal of Judge Aaron Persky, who sentenced a Stanford student-athlete to probation with 6 months in jail for sexual assault. This is Central Time.
Ready for this. We used their technology to strengthen our planet. But it won't be enough.
Clip from the sequel to Independence Day there, Resurgence. Well, yesterday was the 4th of July. In my book, a great time for rewatching the original with Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum. My first time through with my kids who had to cover their eyes, but real super fans exist here in the Central Time office. Amanda Magnus and J. Carlisle Larson. JC, what do you love about this movie, Independence Day?
Well, the original, of course, was, you know, kind of cheesy. And for a kid who was terrified of alien movies, who grew up in Nevada, not near Area 51, but was familiar with it, it was kind of like my first foray into not being afraid of these kinds of movies because it was so silly. But I still love this movie to this day. So,
and you've got a kind of a sweet spot for Jeff Goldblum?
I have had a sweet spot for Jeff Goldblum since Jurassic Park, which says a lot, but peak hotness, Independence Day.
And you saw the new one. Thumbs up?
Thumbs up. I think people should see it. It's not quite as cheesy. It took itself a little bit too seriously.
Excellent. Well, good time for rewatching it and maybe catching the sequel. You're listening to Central Time.